Coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
You can study academically 10 years, if you want to, about the effects of ayahuasca, DMT, psilocybin, whatever it is, on, in terms of epigenetics, neurobiology, emotional biology, neurology in general. And you can learn a lot, right? None of that is going to teach you how to deal with a guy that takes all his clothes off, freaks out, and starts screaming and running in the jungle, right? And this is where the practical experience of facilitation meets the academia about knowing what's happening in the brain and what's happening with the nervous system, what's happening with epigenetics, right? I think what's interesting about modern shamans, and very loosely use that term in quotation marks, is that a modern facilitator of plant medicine work and psychedelics has to know both, right? You have to have practical experience with the range of human reaction to being on plant medicines. And to really be a good facilitator, you do want to understand epigenetics, neurobiology, the role of sound and scent and ceremony. In some ways, it's like a reverse engineering. It's like, oh, well, the shaman said that this is panema, bad stuck energy, right? Well, the Western terminology might be trauma, right? It's like this person's suffering from trauma. It is specific to this particular thing. And because I understand that, I can move them really quickly through it in a ceremonial setting. So the balance of the two is where I'm at. It's what's most exciting me these days about this work.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today's guest is Tony Moss, a respected teacher and plant medicine advocate who's been working with ayahuasca for over 25 years. On the show, we discuss the concept of the shaman, as well as issues with ego and integrity that accompany that title. We talk about how someone can become an ayahuasca ceremony leader through apprenticeship, and Tony shares his approach to handling freakouts. I asked Tony whether it's better to experience ayahuasca in the Amazon, and we go deep on the importance of integration. Tony is a musician, an artist, and founder of I Am Life, a nonprofit event production project focused on interconnectivity. Tony is a public advocate for the decriminalization and responsible use of all plant medicines and is passionate about the synthesis of indigenous and modern worldviews. Tony has led enough ceremonies in legal jurisdictions to see the patterns that aspiring facilitators must be aware of. There's no substitute for practical facilitation experience, no matter how much you've studied, which is why we need elders like Tony Moss to continue to guide the movement of psychedelic medicine. Hi, Tony. It's nice to see you.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, I had you on my podcast, Life is a Festival, and I was certain that we would not do our next interview remotely. And unfortunately, here we are in a state of
global... The world has changed pretty dramatically since then, yeah?
Yeah, everything is remote now. Of course, you've been someone who I've admired in this space for a long time. And so I absolutely wanted you to be one of the first people that I spoke to, particularly around ayahuasca work and ayahuasca work specifically in a Western or maybe American context, because there's obviously a big difference.
Thank you.
Many people consider you to be a major leader in the Western presentation of ayahuasca. And so to start with, do you consider yourself a shaman or a facilitator? How do you consider yourself in your relationship to ayahuasca work?
Yeah, absolutely not a shaman. And we've touched on this before. The reason is, there's so many words in that cross-culturally, you don't know what the hell people are talking about when they use the word, right? And I mean that with the greatest respect. And with the growing popularity of ayahuasca specifically, people who toss around that word appropriately or inappropriately, and I never have any idea what they're talking about. And a lot of the times I'm realizing they don't either, understandably, because of how it's been used. So as we know, the concept of shaman, at least the word actually comes from Siberia. It's not even related to South America. They were actually just healers, which they referred to as curanderos or you know, curanderas, male or female. And the definition of a shaman, I think the most universal translation is someone who can go into the other realms, navigate those experiences, you know, navigate you through those experiences and bring you back. Right. I think that's the most literal, universal explanation of a shaman. What it has become is collapsed into curanderos and curanderas, you know, healers, basically, that actually do like spiritual healing, everything from dark magic to I'm going to remove this negative dark that was thrown at you to I'm going to heal your cancer because the medicines are teaching me how to do it, right? So in that sense, no, I'm definitely not a shaman. I am a now 26 or 7 year veteran of working with ayahuasca, the last 10 years as a facilitator in various situations. And when people ask me about my relationship to plant medicine in general, I always just say that I'm a facilitator, you know, and that facilitation has just come through years of experience and study.
And so, Tony, what is foremost in your focus right now in your field?
What I've said every time we've ever spoken and anytime I ever speak anywhere, which is the evolution of human consciousness right now more than ever. No matter what lens you take to world events, you know, whether your main concern is a pandemic, the rise of totalitarianism, climate, regardless of any of those things, ultimately, the only thing that's going to make a difference is going to be an evolution in human consciousness, right? Looking at the diverse responses to the Trump presidency and the coronavirus in general has shown us the incredible wide spectrum of awareness just within this country, let alone the world, right? And some of the responses that people are having and the things that they are supporting or not supporting and the things that come out of their mouths are shocking, right, to some people. It's like you kind of can't even believe it, right? And there's always a temptation to say, you know, and just let's use this pre vernacular, like you can't believe the ignorance, right, that is surfacing during this period. And that's why I say, you know, grassroots efforts, fine, legislation, let's go for it. Ultimately, none of that will work. What will really work and what is being called for right now in the world is an evolution or a little jump in human consciousness. So that has always been the foundation of the work that I do. I've always seen plant medicine work as a form of activism for me, right? And I think more than ever in the world, we're seeing that now. But anyway, that's what's most important to me and is even more important now and I'm recommitted to is the psycho-spiritual benefits of working with psychedelics and plant medicines, not only healing the past trauma, but as my friend Sonny says, they also help cure stupidity. Like literally, like it can actually help bring people out of the confines and restrictions of cultural and other conditioning, right? Just for a moment that you can kind of move, pull your head out of your ass, right? And get out of your own story for a minute and have a sense of interconnectivity, have a global view. Think for a moment in terms of species consciousness instead of your own personal survival. All those things are benefits that we get from plant medicine work, you know, and psychedelic work in general, right? They give you some breathing room where suddenly, you know, the unconscious becomes conscious. It's a phrase that I heard recently. And for a lot of people, just one night of that can change your entire life.
Do you do much teaching or mentoring of other facilitators? I would imagine that in your goal of advancing human consciousness, in order to maximize that, helping to train and up-level other facilitators must be an important part of that work for you. Is that the case?
Surprisingly, no. But it's one of those yes and no's. So, yeah, just through default, there's a few people who have just entered my field that work with me on a regular basis. So yeah, there's like a student teacher mentor, you know, mentoree type of relationship that has organically evolved. And there are people that who have just encountered my work over the years who on a regular basis contact me from any place in the world and are just looking for advice or counsel on a particular aspect of their work. So yeah, there's a little of that for sure. It's not what dominates my work, no, surprisingly. You would think so, but no.
What is the most common, when you say that there are people who ask you questions from time to time who are familiar with your work and are practicing themselves, what are some of the most common questions that those facilitators that are looking to your guidance ask you about?
Well, you know, humorously enough, the most common questions are dealing with people who freak out, yeah. As you can imagine. The most common questions are not the romantic ones or the ones that are, you know, exciting to talk about. It's things like who should or should not be allowed to participate in various ceremonies, depending on, let's say, mental health issues or medications. There's some set and setting questions. And, this woman freaked out in ceremony and did this and that and ran out. And I'm just wondering if I did the right thing or how would you approach that? I get questions like that, you know, which are super important. Because you can study academically 10 years, if you want to, about the effects of ayahuasca, DMT, you know, psilocybin, whatever it is, on, you know, in terms of epigenetics, neurobiology, emotional biology, yeah, neurology in general. And you can learn a lot, right? None of that is going to teach you how to deal with a guy that takes all his clothes off, freaks out, and starts screaming and running in the jungle, right? And this is where the practical facilitation experience of facilitation meets the academia about knowing what's happening in the brain, what's happening with the nervous system, what's happening with epigenetics, right? I think what's interesting about modern shamans, and very loosely use that term in quotation marks, is that a modern facilitator of plant medicine work and psychedelics has to know both, right? You have to have practical experience with the range of human reaction to being on plant medicines. And to really be a good facilitator, you do want to understand epigenetics, you know, neurobiology, the role of sound and scent in ceremony, right? Yeah, because this makes you a much better facilitator, you know, understanding, you know, trauma, you know, and PTSD and what it looks like, because sometimes that's what it is and doesn't necessarily look like it. But if you're a trained facilitator, you can recognize what it is. And as opposed to running over, you know, blowing flower water on somebody, you might actually have a more profound technique that, and I'm not saying that that doesn't work, right? But there's a lot of techniques and tools and insights that Western thought and research has brought to the world of plant medicine that is invaluable, right? In some ways, it's like a reverse engineering. It's like, oh, well, the shaman said that this is panema, bad stuck energy, right? Well, the Western terminology might be trauma. Right? It's like this person suffering from trauma. It is specific to this particular thing. And because I understand that, I can move them really quickly through it in a ceremonial setting. So the balance of the two is where I'm at. It's what's most exciting me these days about this work, actually. Yeah.
Can you think of an occasion where you've held a ceremony and you've had a guest in that ceremony who has freaked out in some way? Someone is having an experience that is an authentic, legitimate, and important experience that they're having. It's clearly an important part of their healing process, but it has overwhelmed the whole circle. Can you think of a time that you've responded to that and what you chose to do in those moments?
Yeah, there's been several. And fortunately, because of the way the spaces are held, there's not a lot of them. And I'm not just saying this up for myself. I mean, the way ceremonies in general, I'm going to speak specifically of ayahuasca, are being held in the greater ayahuasca community through sharing of information and best practices, there's less and less freakouts, right? And it's because we call the containers being held so well. That said, there, as you mentioned, there are some authentic breakthrough, word I'm looking for, we'll just say freakouts, right? That happen and, you know, will continue to happen in ceremony. They're a valuable part of the ceremony. It's like having, you know, a psychotic break, but in a good way. And what I mean by that is getting to the very boundary of where your psyche, your known reality is held together. And then the plant medicine, in this case, ayahuasca, pushes you slightly beyond that. And then there's a fight or flight response from some people. And there can be a complete and total freak out. So when that happens and it's overwhelming for the room, it depends on what I know about the person having the freak out. But in general, your first goal is to minimize the impact. And there's a delicate balance. You don't want to eclipse the person's cathartic experience, right? Because it could be a life-changing moment. And at the same time, you don't want it to derail the ceremony as a whole either, right? So what I generally teach our crew is you have to give the thing an arc, right? You have to let the freak out kind of reach its apex as quickly as possible, right? And then start to bring it down. And I don't remove people from the room for that to happen unless it's absolutely necessary. And part of the reason is that everything that happens in ceremony is part of ceremony, right? I think we've chatted about this. I think people underestimate how well people cognize what's happening in ceremony. And a person having a complete freak out sometimes is a catalyst for everybody else's healing experience, right? And they'll share that later in sharing circles. Like, oh my gosh, the person's like apologizing. I'm so sorry, you guys. And they're like, no. When you had that experience, you know, it reminded me of this one thing, or suddenly I felt it was okay to cry, or, you know, your experience became my experience. And so that's not necessarily a problem. However, you also don't want it to go longer than necessary, right? So my approach always is tend to it immediately. The entire room needs to know and see that you're handling it, right? What's most important is that people feel safe. Right? So this is what I've learned. I'm very visibly dealing with upsets in ceremony, because what I've learned is most important is that all the other participants know that you're on top of it, right? It allows them to relax into their experience and know that this is under control, right? And, you know, to some degree, mostly it is under control, right? But I'm just saying that for practitioners, I can't stress enough, part of your responsibility is at all times to create a container of safety. And part of that is people in the room, because they're in a very delicate, vulnerable state, need to feel confident in your ability to facilitate. So if someone's freaking out, no matter how bad it is, if they see that you're handling it in a mature way, they're like, oh, okay, so-and-so's got it, right? What's really bad is you coming across as not handling it or immediately ushering the person out of the room, which doesn't make everybody feel safe necessarily, right? You know, and it kind of also gives the impression like, oh, it's really bad if you freak out. They're going to, like, you know, give you a timeout. So all of that said, what I find it's best to do is to handle the thing immediately. Let everybody see that you're handling it. Don't try to make it bad, right? Just treat it as part of the ceremony. And as soon as possible, bring it down. And we like to say, have the person coast down. Part of that can definitely be taking the person to another space where they can continue with their journey and not upset the room. I'm just saying that you don't want to get into the habit of that being your default, that the second somebody is disruptive, you remove them from the room. Because if you think about it, it's like, then what are you doing the work for? You know, it's like, by the very nature of having a psychedelic or plant medicine ceremony, you're inviting the unconscious to conscious, right? Anything can happen in that space. So what you don't want to give people the impression is that you know, it's like taking with no offense intended, it's like taking an empty sacrament and a, you know, empty ritual, right? Yeah, the idea is that this is an authentic ceremony, meaning it's an authentic sacrament, and you're inviting people to have a cathartic experience. So you don't want to give them the impression that it's not okay to do it, right? And at the same time, you have to have some boundaries. Like, hey, this isn't just about you. It's not going to be a self-indulgent moment. If it's authentic, it's welcome. If it's not, we're going to handle it outside.
Right. Well, in a sense, in that ceremony, you are the wise self. And the ceremony is made up of different fragmented parts. And we're all looking to you to hold the harmony.
And when be an adult.
And to be an adult, exactly. And we get to feel our different parts in the stewardship of your facilitation. And so if you allow that person to have that explosive experience, and I watch you holding the container for her, I feel held by you in that moment too. And I feel that I can be held with her intense trauma. And that in a sense is also modeling to me that I can hold the piece in myself that has intense trauma alongside the other parts of myself. And it's kind of, this is like internal family system stuff too. Like the different pieces of myself in harmony represents a fully functioning, healthy adult. And the ceremony setting can map to that. That's what I feel like I'm hearing you say. And based on my own experience, seems to be true.
Yeah. I like that analogy because people have shared things really similar in sharing circle. The morning following an ayahuasca ceremony, for instance, I'll find out that the most significant healing that happened in the room was everybody's response to how I or a guardian handled an upset. And that ended up being the, you know, the apex of the whole ceremony. And it wasn't the thing itself. It was watching how it unfolded, watching how it was treated, right? What it brought up for people. And everything you brought up, this modeling of like, you know, oh, I felt safe. You know, you became like the adult or the tribal leader or the father in that moment. I started to reflect on my own relationship with my family. Like all these dynamics start to play themselves out. Beautifully so. This is why you can't go to South America and do a 3-month shaman course and come back and start leading ceremony, right? Because you don't have enough experience, period. I don't care who you worked with, right? How accredited they are and what lineage they come from, right? What you're missing is the years of actually sitting in ceremony and watching all these experiences unfold, knowing how to address them and knowing what actually works for people and what doesn't. You know, I've had friends relatively recently tell me that they went to a ceremony, and these were predominantly young people, you know, that had studied with so-and-so, the shaman. And they said it became really clear that they were really irritated by anything that disrupted their music flow. So they really wanted to put on an ayahuasca concert, and they wanted you to praise them for doing it. And they were irritated with any of your upsets and purging. Right? So yeah, and a lot of people that have listening just that have been in these experiences know exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, look, if you want to host an ayahuasca concert, then call it that and do it, right? But if you're going to host an actual psycho-spiritual session where the intent is for people to come and do their healing work, right, then everything else you're doing is secondary, right, to that experience. And I've often said to younger people, it's like when they ask me, oh, do you think I'm ready to lead ceremony? You know, I go, look, if you're not ready to handle the worst case scenario in a ceremony, then you shouldn't be leading one, because it's going to happen, right? So if you can't handle somebody taking all their clothes off, screaming at the top of their lungs, charging to the front door and running down the street in the middle of the night, which most of us have done, while everybody, including you, is on medicine work, then you have no business leading that ceremony, right? Because you're endangering not only all the people in the ceremony, endangering the, you know, the person, of course, having the experience, it's also a danger to the entire medicine community, right?
Yeah. And what you were just describing in terms of how people become ayahuasca facilitators, what I've experienced in the ceremonies that I've sat in is that there are, I think the term you used was guardian, but there are almost apprentices that are supporting the facilitator. If someone's listening to this podcast right now, and that what they want more than anything in the world is to facilitate ayahuasca work, it transformed their lives. They know, they're clear, this is my path and I want to do it. It seems to me like the best way to approach that would be through this sort of informal apprenticeship where you're sitting in many, many ceremonies, including also training in the Amazon and training in different ways, but that there's a long period of apprenticeship. Is there a general understanding within the ayahuasca community that that's the right approach? Do you feel like that's the right approach?
I don't know about the right approach. I can tell you that that is by default become the approach, and it works. You know, just echoing what you said, you know, generally what happens is, yeah, you sit in as many ceremonies as you can with people that you trust or that have been recommended. Eventually you have to settle on a teacher or two, right? And the reason is because you have to sit consistently with a particular person or tradition, right? So that you can ask all the appropriate questions and encounter a lot of the situations that are going to arise, right? What happens eventually, typically, is that at some point, this is why choosing a teacher or teachers and a tradition is important. Since you can't really gauge yourself when you're ready to start your independent leading ceremony, you're relying on your teacher to tell you, right? Your elder. So, you know, at some point they'll say, hey, I think you're ready to lead a little ceremony. Or you might go to them and say, 3 friends asked me if I would facilitate for them this weekend. What do you think? Right. And then your teacher might honestly say, yeah, I think you're ready to do that. Or like, there's no way in hell you should be doing that. Right. They may or may not be wrong. But if you think about it, what else are you going to do? Right. It's not like there is a course, right, that has these milestones that you meet, you check out these boxes, and eventually at the end it says, here's your certificate, you can now go deal with freakouts, right? So I guess ultimately what I'm saying is there has to be a feedback loop, and that feedback loop is coming from the community that you're a part of, right, which is why you want to be in one, as opposed to bouncing around everywhere, and from the elders or facilitators that you've chosen to work with. You need some kind of consistent feedback loop to gauge any of us in anything, right, to gauge where we're at any given point. Which is why, you know, again, the most disastrous experiences I've heard about in the last 5-6 years, you know, terrible experiences people have had in ayahuasca ceremonies, every single time has been from someone relatively young who decided at some point to call themselves a shaman, right, and just started leading ceremony. And they're not necessarily connected to a traditional lineage or a teacher. So just case in point, you know. Then there are people who I've met recently who I know have been around for like 10 years or so. And then little by little, through community feedback and, you know, their elders or their teachers, they've gotten the green light, like, you know, you should really be doing ceremony. And they do, and they're good at it. So it's this interesting self-regulating system that's in place that I think has a lot of variations in it, but basically it does work. And what I like about it is, you know, what you kind of alluded to, it's very similar to where our ancestors worked, right? Basically, you sit with elders and there's young people. In every ceremony, yeah, typically what you're going to have is elders, right, facilitating to some degree, with varying degrees of young people in roles of facilitation, musicianship, and kind of helping. In the Santo Daime tradition, they call them guardians, the helpers, which is why I use that term. Some people just call them helpers, you know, some people call them sitters. But yeah, there's people that basically help with all of the nuts and bolts of the ceremony that allow the facilitators to really focus on the group dynamic of the ceremony, right? And then in that process, the helpers are always, generally, with rare exception, they're typically, known to themselves or not, they're also apprentices. Because sometimes it creeps up on you, right?
There's a wonderful duo that I sat with. The curandero is a traditional Quechua-speaking shaman and does not speak English, speaks Spanish. And his co-facilitator is a young American therapist. And so the young American therapist helps kind of translate and takes care of the logistics and helps with a lot of the integration. And then the curandero is sort of the master of the full ceremony.
And that's a great combination, by the way. I don't want to interrupt, but that's becoming a pretty normal working model, and I really like it, right? Yeah, because it's Eagle Condor, which we won't get into, but you're taking the indigenous wisdom, knowledge, and experience and marrying it with Western thought, research, academia, and cultural understanding. Right. Yeah. So to work with like a Peruvian shaman, you know, whose assistant is a young American therapist is usually a pretty winning combination if both people are on top of their game.
Yeah. And I think this is a great segue to a question that a lot of folks have about ayahuasca and ayahuasca work, which is it better to be doing this work in the Amazon? And I know a lot of people who would say, well, I would never do an ayahuasca ceremony in America. That would be, that's the wrong thing. I need to go to the Amazon to do it. And I'm curious what your perspective is on this and what you might say to someone who would say that there's no such thing as an authentic ceremony outside of the Amazon.
So several questions. The short answer to the initial question is, do you need to go to the Amazon or in South America anywhere to do ayahuasca ceremony? No. Hands down, no. That's not just my opinion. That's just true, right? What I mean by that is, in the world of plant medicine in general, although you will find people who will answer yes to that, the general obvious response is no. And that's partially because of the popularity and onset of Western what we're calling ayahuasca tourism. Someone new to the world of plant medicine and new to the world of ayahuasca, your chances of going to South America and finding a authentic, legitimate ayahuasca ceremony that is as safe and healthy as one it is you would find, let's say in California, are slim to nil, right? You kind of have to be in the world of ayahuasca to even know where to go in South America. The success of your experience in South America relative to ayahuasca is completely relative to what it is you're looking for, right? If what you want is healing from ayahuasca, you don't need to go to the Amazon for that, right? There's a lot of facilitators all over the world at this point who are doing really good work. And I know because they report it back to me all the time. If you want to study, however, right, if your goal is to study shamanisms, to study the various traditions, and I, again, shamanism in quotation marks, if you want to study plant medicine work, in this case, ayahuasca, and you want to go to South America to do it, you kind of have to, meaning there's so many different traditions, right? So many different takes on it. And only a there's a handful of authentic, at least elder maestros and maestras left, right? Yeah, you'd want to go there and spend some time and get that under your belt. Is it necessary for your healing or necessary for your training as a facilitator? Absolutely not. It's a luxury and it's a cool thing to be able to do, right? It's not a necessary thing to do.
And I think about that kind of like with meditation. You know, there are these incredible meditation teachers like Jack Kornfield or Tara Brach who, you know, maybe 50 years ago, you wouldn't find those folks in the United States or elsewhere in the world. You'd find those folks in Asia. But now in the globalized milieu of the world, these incredible teachers can rise up out of any kind of cultural tradition as long as they're deeply studied and have the experiences to be able to facilitate the healing.
And it's appropriate. You want that. You know, I've spoken on this many times, and you and I have touched on it in the past, too. Example I would use would be like, there's a group of 20 young Black men who live in South Central who want to do ayahuasca because they want to, you know, get some insight into some trauma and maybe how past traumatic experiences are influencing their behavior, right? They're definitely smart enough to echo exactly what I just said because I've talked to them, right? So bringing in a Peruvian shaman, you know, from Iquitos to sit with these guys is not going to be as effective as somebody who understands them culturally, can speak their language, and actually knows their experience, right? Who also has, obviously, credentials and experience with plant medicine, right? I'm saying that at least the person facilitating with this, let's say we do bring in the shaman, right? And like we said, that winning combination of, you know, the Western person with the indigenous elder, I have found that what's beautiful during the psychedelic renaissance is how the medicine is adapted, right, for each culture that it finds itself in and needs to be, right, so that it can be as effective as possible, right? Yeah, so the adaptation and the evolution of the medicine, you know, which is, again, why going to Peru or any place where the medicine has its indigenous roots is so valuable. The main reason you want to study that is so that you know what it is you're adapting, right? So that you can come back to Chicago, right? And basically apply everything it is that you learn, everything that you learn in South America, but through a particular cultural lens and facilitation that's going to meet people where they're at and have the most profound impact possible. Because I often say, you know, it comes down again to what it is you're after, right? If each facilitator has to do this at some point, like, are you facilitating ceremony because you want to be in the story of a shaman? You want to be seen as a shaman? You know, I want to play out the story of being a shaman, right? Great, no problem with that. Or is it because you're committed to healing? And whether it's psycho-spiritual healing, physical healing, evolving consciousness, right? If your goal is to heal, right, then you want to have the most, like any doctor, you want to have the most effective practice possible. And if that means modifying what you learned in Peru to fit a particular group of people, you do it. However, if your commitment is to, well, this is the way my teacher did it, I'm doing the most authentic, you know, ceremony possible, so I'm just going to go through these motions and do these particular things because that's the way it's done, right? I think you're missing the point, right? I'll give you one example. When I was doing a dieta in Peru with this beautiful master, she's like 70 years old, and what basically happened is someone said to her through a translator, is it okay if we sing? The translator, without checking in with her, immediately responded, well, yeah, but only if you can sing and catch one, you know the songs. Well, somebody translated that to the master, and I think I told you the story before. And she said, no. She said, I'm singing to you in my language because it's a language I know. She said, if I could sing to you in English, I would. Yeah. The point of that is that just because it's traditional doesn't mean it's most appropriate, right? It just means it's traditional, right? And there's a lot to be learned from that. But a really wise person, a contemporary facilitator, knows how to absorb everything, right, that they've learned, and then apply it appropriately to different situations. We have to adapt, right? Yeah. And what she was saying was that the power of the meaning, not of all of them, because there's a beautiful healing that just comes through the vibration and the cadence, right, and the melody and the voices during ceremony. You don't need to understand what they're singing. However, we've had plenty of experiences, and you've had them too, where, you know, you're in your process and all of a sudden one piece of a lyric comes through, which might be, "Dear me, I forgive you." And then your whole world falls apart, right? Mm. You wouldn't have gotten that if it hadn't been spoken in English, right? Or should I say, if it hadn't been spoken in a language you could relate to, right? Yeah, and doing things like cleansings in ceremony, if you do it in a traditional way that people don't know what the heck you're doing, it may not be as powerful as people being able to recognize what you're doing, right? So again, these are just subtle ways of how facilitators adapt tradition to make their healing practice as poignant as possible, right? As beneficial as possible.
There was something that you said in there that I want to zero in on because I think it's so interesting and important. You talked about how the motivation for facilitating ayahuasca could be for the goal of global healing, could be to advance human consciousness. But what you also said is it could be because you want to play the story of a shaman.
Yeah.
And I think that what's interesting is you have less of that when it comes to, you know, ketamine assisted therapy and being a ketamine assisted therapy doctor. That doesn't have the same sort of cultural weight of being a shaman.
The romanticism.
Exactly. Yeah. But what you said is you said you might want to play the story of a shaman, and that's okay. And I think that there's an interesting edge here because some of us get involved in the space of psychedelic healing because of the romance of the psychedelic space and because of the idea of our own selves in the identity of shaman or psychedelic healer. And when you said that's okay, I appreciated that because I think that there is a welcoming in for that perhaps ego-driven instinct to bring you to the work that then could potentially evolve. But there's also dark sides and tricks to the ego-driven shamanism as well. So I'd love for you just to speak on ego and shamanism just broadly.
That is a multi-layered conversation that is in reality probably beyond the scope of what it is we're trying to accomplish. And for this reason, first of all, existentially, maybe speaking, everything is permitted, right? It's okay. If where you're at currently in your journey is, I want to be the shaman, right? I want to be seen as the shaman. I want the power of the shaman. I want people to see me and recognize me. If that's your story and that's motivating you to go to Peru and learn, it's like, fine, go do it. And if you find some people that want to play along in that story with you, I want to be sitting with the young person who says he's a shaman. I want to be dominated by the shaman. I have much to learn from the egoic person being the shaman, like whatever. There's cost and impact to all of that, of course, you know. But I'm saying the other part of that, the reason why I say it's okay is generally that's just what gets you in the door, right? So that's what I'm talking about when I say it's okay. If early on what you're attracted to is the prestige, right, and the status, right, if that's what attracts you initially and begins your studies, chances are pretty good that somewhere in that process your ego's going to get, you know, a good ass whooping, right, or at least in nicer language, it will start to get exposed, right, and a transformation takes place. And at some point, in a lot of cases, not all, the person starts to realize, like, and question their original motives. It's like, wow, I've been pretending to be a healer. What I'm really seeing is that I'm full of it, that I really just, like, want to be seen as the healer. I'm not really particularly interested in healing. I want the ego gratification of celebrity status of being a healer. You know, one guy once said to me, you know, he didn't say to me, actually, he said to somebody who sat with me, he told this young woman, he goes, oh, you can forget about sitting with that Toni Moss. You want to travel with me? I sit with the A-list people. I travel all around the world. I was like, whoa. That was so humorous to hear. And I find out later, this person has been thrown out of several communities, right? For everything from sexual abuse to just, you know, hugely inappropriate egoic behavior. You know, so it's one of the cases where the slow whittling down of the ego and the self-reflecting transformation did not take place, or at least it hasn't yet. Generally, that is what happens. At some point, usually there's this one ceremony where the medicine's like talking to you and you suddenly realize like, oh my goodness, I'm full of shit, right? And at that moment, the medicine's like, it's completely okay that you're full of shit. Everybody's full of shit, right? The cool thing is that you recognize it now and let's get on with your studies so you can really bring some healing to people.
And you know, you mentioned this idea of wanting to be seen. And I think wanting to be seen represents a major wound that many of us are wanting to use these medicines to heal. Why do I feel so unseen? Why do I, and this is, I mean, you know me well enough to know that this is a huge part of my motivation that has is like, I want to be seen. And what I've learned is that I'm actually most nourished when I am seen in a way that also helps others to be seen and helps others to shine. And so part of why I wanted to flag this idea of wanting to play the shaman is okay. Now, of course, there are things that are not okay. You know,
of course, is not okay. Abuse of power is not okay.
Yeah, there are things that are not okay. But this motivation to be seen as the shaman, you know, that's okay. That's an okay place to start. That's an okay place to approach this work. And I think that's important to be said because there's so much shame around ego in spiritual communities. And then there's ego about not having ego. And then there's shame, like the ego shame spiral in spiritual communities is so unhelpful.
And it's also absolutely everything he said. And there is the authentic wanting to be seen. And that's why I said, you know, we could dedicate a whole conversation just to this, and we won't. But I want to qualify, everybody wants to be seen, right? Meaning, if you're alive, right, and you're on the planet, there is this level of participation. There's a level of wanting to be seen, wanting to be acknowledged, wanting to share, right? Wanting to be, what you want to be seen as is a story put on top of that, right? So everybody wants to be seen, right? You could say in a much more esoteric way, you know, all of creation wants to be experienced, right? So every being is carrying this spark of God that wants to be seen. Right. And then you choose in all the ways you want to be seen. You choose healthy or unhealthy. You choose. And that seeing also translates into contribution. Right. I want to contribute to creation. It's like people go to Burning Man. Maybe the first year or two, all you do is enjoy the party and the labors of everyone else. Maybe the third year, it's like, actually, I want to participate. I want to bring an art car. I want to give away food. Right. You go from this initial, I need attention and I want to be seen. And the cathartic, like, look at me, I'm in a crazy costume and I'm making it, woohoo, and like the egoic thing, which is beautiful. And then it gets to like, actually, what is my authentic sharing? Like, if I could wear anything in the world and express myself, what would that be? Right? So then you just keep going down this beautiful self-inquiry rabbit hole. Eventually, you might have landed a place of, actually, I don't want to be seen at all. I want to contribute and have everybody else have this beautiful experience. Every place on that spectrum is okay. Right. And that's what I mean when I say in terms of the world of ayahuasca shamanism, wanting to be seen is OK. It's a completely OK place to be on the spectrum. It's not a healthy place to stay, right, for your entire career, but it's certainly an OK place to be.
Right. And I'm noticing this really beautiful thread in our conversation about things being welcome. You know, the outburst in the ceremony is welcome. The ego that brings the facilitator to study plant medicine facilitation, that's also welcome. And I think that a lot of the value of psychedelic healing is around bringing back these exiled aspects of ourselves, loving ourselves as we are, seeing through these beautiful psychedelic visions that there is less separation than we believed there was, and that so much pain is from that separation, and so much frustration is the limiting beliefs that keep us stuck in the idea of separation. And so I just think it's so beautiful to see, you know, this thread of like, yes, let the person who has the outburst, they deserve to be in the ceremony, and they deserve to have their outburst be a cathartic arc. And at the same time, the role of the facilitator is to know that pacing and know when it's okay for that to be there and when to begin to wind it down and when to say, okay, we'll actually do need to move you into another room where a guardian is going to sit with you to maintain the integrity of this space. And what you've said is that that's an art that is built over a long period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we come back to the idea of experience. You know, it's even through experience that you can hold the sense of welcoming that you're talking about. It is crucial in any psychedelic therapeutic work or in plant medicine group work. What is most important for any facilitator, any place, and anybody experienced will tell you the same thing. Your first and top priority is for the person to feel welcome, meaning to feel safe. If they don't, you have an uphill battle right away, right? Right? You're asking someone or a group of people to come into a space and willingly open their psyche to you and move into vulnerability, right? And trust you to guide this journey, right? Yeah, so that sense of safety and welcome, which in my circles, you know, we actually spend a good amount of time on in the early stages of making sure that by the time the ceremony starts, to the degree that you can, you've made every person feel welcome and comfortable, right? And safe, right? Because it's going to allow them to actually relax into the experience, you know, and not have the one eye open the whole time, you know, out of fear for their safety or just concern that the crew or the facilitator doesn't know what the hell they're doing, right? Yeah, and people have asked me, you know, variations of a question like, oh, I went to this ceremony and, yeah, I just got a really bad feeling about the facilitator and but my friend, you know, brought me, so I went ahead and stayed, and it was terrible. I always tell people, if you don't feel safe, get the heck out of there, right? Period. What do you got to lose? You know, it's like, you could be wrong. Yeah, you could be bringing your whole story of fear and maybe a story of judgment about the person, whatever it is, right? But then that becomes a beautiful opportunity to do some self-inquiry and look at that. But in general, if you arrive at a location that feels unsafe, chances are pretty good that it is, right? Mm-hmm. And take responsibility for yourself. Right?
I wanted to ask you something, and perhaps I should have asked you this at the beginning of the podcast, but I'm curious why you chose ayahuasca. And there are a number of different psychedelic compounds and traditions of holding space for others. And I'm curious, have you facilitated healing with any other medicines or modalities? And why do you feel that ayahuasca is such a valuable tool? What is it about ayahuasca that is so close to your heart that is made that plant the core of your facilitation and gift?
Yeah. Well, the short answer is, you know, I don't mean this kind of metaphorically or evasively. It's like I didn't choose it, it chose me. And what I mean by that is it was just circumstances. You know, it was the one that showed up that had a profound transformational experience in my own life. And one thing led to another. And quite literally, before you knew it, I was leading ceremony. I didn't choose to. I mean, I didn't have a goal to do it. It wasn't an ambition. And so that's how it happened. Why I continue doing it is because it works, right? And it just turns out that I had an affinity for it. It's just a medicine that I understand through and through, both maybe innately and also through a lot of experience Yes, your other question is, I've facilitated different types of ceremonies and psychotherapy with other substances. And at some point, it became clear to me, you know, that at least in terms of plant medicines, I'm not particularly polyamorous. I am definitely monogamous with ayahuasca. And I appreciate all the others. And again, I've had experiences with them, but it is just the one that called to me. And again, that I have the most mature relationship with, you know, that I just understand it. And part of that healthy understanding is the weird shock that 27 years later, I hardly understand it at all. You know, it's amazing that it still reveals itself on a regular basis, but within a realm of understanding for me, right, and safety, right, that I can navigate. And the other part of your question, I will say, what's really the difference between ayahuasca and the others? Why I would work with it? Ayahuasca offers I'm being careful of what I'm about to say because new therapies are different, right? Traditionally, ayahuasca offers the longest period of drop-in in a cathartic way. Like, you can be on LSD for a much longer period of time, but not all of that is productive, right? And not all of it is cathartic, right? You can do DMT and have an amazing experience within the last 12 minutes, right? And I often have jokingly said, and maybe last time we talked, DMT is like, you know, a being lifts the curtain and that invites you to peek in, right? And then closes the curtain again. Ayahuasca is like, lift the curtain, go inside, hang out for a while, right? And then eventually come back out, safely, and then we're going to close the curtain behind you. I have found that of all the plant medicines and other psychoactive substances or experiences that I've had or been privileged to work with, ayahuasca has had the most long-lasting benefits for people overall, right? And again, that I have to qualify by saying that has all shifted now with advances and the maturity and sophistication of psychedelic therapy. You know, people definitely are having profound life-changing experiences now in one session of, you know, psilocybin, you know, assisted therapy or MDMA assisted therapy. There are some practitioners now working with DMT that have really learned how to make use of those 12 or 15 minutes, right, in a profound way with, you know, preparation and, you know, post-integration work. And so it's gotten very sophisticated. So ayahuasca, I think certainly in the past, everything I said was true. It offered the most long-lasting, stable, beneficial overall, you know. But at this point, for me, it's mainly just because it's like the marriage of my life, right? It's just happened, right? And I love it, so there's no reason to deter from it. I don't at this point think it's the best thing in the world, right? I just know that it works consistently.
I think it's in part for me, it's the MAO inhibitor. The fact that there is a wash of serotonin in the experience and the sense of safety that because I have issues around serotonin in my system. So that fact of it is really powerful. The fact that ayahuasca feels like a reciprocal consciousness, it does not feel like I am on drugs. It feels like I am being visited by a being of wisdom. And I feel like ayahuasca knows, you know, ayahuasca knows the next step and gives me the courage and the safety and the sweeping psychedelic vistas that are so entertaining and beautiful for me to take that next step. And as a participant in these healing circles, her mystery is so profound for me and the deepening wisdom that is available. And I wonder for you, 27 years, are you still feeling these upgrades and these deepening moments where you're like, wow, I'm getting a whole new perspective from this moment? Do you feel like there's just a sort of never-ending fractal depth of what can be discovered in the ayahuasca experience? Or is it
you nailed it. Life is never-ending fractal depth, right? And ayahuasca is a reflection of life, ultimately. It seen through a lens of clarity that we don't normally have access to, right? An example would be the experience he had, you know? So you can intellectually understand that you've been traumatized, right? And then you can have the ceremony where you suddenly realize, oh, no, I really was traumatized. And now I'm seeing how that trauma has played out in my life. It's like, great, that's really beneficial. Next ceremony, I'm actually in the trauma. I'm shaking. Well, why is that of value? Well, because it feels good. Something really dramatic is happening to me, right? I'm experiencing something really dramatic in my human experience, right? Well, that's valuable, right? From that, you're like, oh, actually, I'm done with that now, right? I'm not only done with the fear of what happened to me, I'm over now the effects of what happened to me. It's no longer playing out in my life. Oh, next ceremony, guess what? The entire world that you live in is an illusion. It's actually a simulation that you live in, right? Where was your drama in the context of that? That was a huge leap I made on purpose, because that's exactly what happens with psychedelic work and with ayahuasca, is all these little fractals of experience start to build on each other. And there could be that one moment where the whole thing dissolves and you start laughing because you realize the entire thing was just a theater of God to begin with, right? Like, yes, something happened to you. No, nothing happened to you, right? There's pain and suffering in the world. Nobody's suffering in the world. You start playing out these paradoxes, right, that all you can do with in any given moment is to be present to and glean what's possible to learn or experience in that moment. And that's never ending. The world is constantly changing. So my perspective and appreciation for the world is constantly changing. Who I am in the world is constantly changing. So something that I thought I completely handled, let's say a judgment about a particular kind of people, I've thought that was long since gone. Suddenly I'm in ceremony and that an archetypal representation of that person is there. And I'm like, oh man, I thought I handled that. I'm having all kinds of, you know, negative thoughts about this tour. Oh, but wait, it doesn't matter. I'm in a simulation. So this ricocheting perspective, which is what it is, of the mind, is an endless journey and a worthy one, right? Because if you think about it, it's like, why else are we here except to have experiences, one, and the other is to evolve and grow and learn from them. And that's never ending. So in that sense, there's a constant upgrading of one's ability to perceive reality, one's ability to understand humanity, right? To study and understand what healing actually is, you know, what's being healed, who's being healed from what, where, right? At any given moment, your personal story might suddenly find you contemplating the nature of existence and the Big Bang and what banged, right? Your whole conversation and ceremony might be something as huge as what's on the other side of the observable universe. And it could be as profound as you reliving a childhood trauma and shaking and realizing this is a human experience. This one moment of your life shaped your entire journey, right? They're equally valid. They're equally important.
I love that. And it helps eliminate the separation between healing and spiritual expansion. What I think is most valuable in the ayahuasca experience, and for the practitioners who are working with different medicines, this isn't exclusive to ayahuasca, but I find it most poignantly in ayahuasca, is exactly as you've said, that there's this kind of expanding consciousness. There's the width of the soul's potential is revealed in these sweeping psychedelic vistas. And then we have this noble journey of the integration, which I know that you are such a huge proponent for the importance of integration in psychedelic healing.
It's key. It's the most important.
Yeah. Which is why we're ending on it.
Without integration, you're just tripping, right? And that is a general statement. It's not always true. And what I mean by that is there's a place for tripping. Huge insights and revelations can come from just tripping, right? However, what is the purpose of it if it can't be integrated into life lived in some way, right? Otherwise, it just becomes this self-indulgent, you know, some people have said, you know, this one guy said to me, a self-indulgent masturbation of personal healing, that every single ceremony is you and your personal healing. It's like, aren't you healed already? It's like, well, yeah, that's a trap, right? The arc that I've seen people go on is there's initial just being blown away that there are other alternatives. I'm talking about with an ayahuasca experience, right? Psychedelics in general. Usually first there's like, we call it, oh God. It's like, oh my God, there really is something. There's this other realm where God exists, or there's dimensions, right? Then there's a personal healing that takes place, right? Over whatever gamut of time that happens, right? On the other side of that, there is a wanting to participate in healing in general. There's a sense of interconnectivity. You know, my healing is everybody's healing. I want to participate and bring this to the world. Now, why? Because some part of you knows that every single person's healing is your healing. That's why you're doing it, right? So what that you figured out what your triggers are? It's like, great, you know, now you're less traumatic. Well, here's where it makes a big difference. When you are, let's say, at a rally, right, and there's a bunch of people with opposing views on the other side of the street carrying signs and flipping you off, right, and everything about your liberal way of being is a threat to their existence, right? Rather than be reactionary, you recognize trauma because you've already gone, it's like, ah, right? I understand why they feel that way. I understand why what I'm thinking is a threat to them, right? I understand why they have the values that they do, right? Because you have an understanding of how the human psyche works and how we're all conditioned and we're running on these stories, right? That's a very valuable place to stand, right? And we have to have if you've got 10,000 people at a rally, right? And let's say 8,000 of them are about to go ballistic because they don't have access to this information. But there's another 1,000 or two that can go, whoa, wait a minute, simmer down. Because that group understands what's actually happening underneath. Right? That's why we want to heal, right? And that's where this work ultimately gets integrated, right? Is not only integrating, a lot of people have said this and I agree with it. Basically, it's like, if it doesn't make you a better human being, why do it, right? The whole point of it is that you can be a better human, right? Like, enjoy the human experience more, participate more, understand people more, you know. Like I said, be the person not going postal at the post office, right? Be the person that can mediate conflict because you understand what's underneath the conflict. Those are all the ways that the psychedelic and psychospiritual work with plant medicines get integrated into life, not just your life, but life.
That's a very nice place to land. the integrating, not just in our own lives, but with all of life. And I love this arc of the wholeness and the inclusivity of in our being and in the circle and in the broader space of life. I'd like to end with the question, if you could speak to the potential ayahuasca facilitator, the potential ketamine-assisted therapy practitioner, the therapist listening right now who's been enjoying this conversation, if you could speak directly to them and just share anything from your heart that you'd like to share with people who are taking on this work of psychedelic healing, what would you want to share?
I think the most valuable and important thing I can share is to know what it is that you're committed to and be fully committed to it. Right? And harking back to what you said earlier, what I mean by that is fully understand what's motivating you to do the work, right? And be committed to that. If it's because you want to heal trauma specifically, then learn everything there is to know and fully hold the space of trauma healing. If in that work you realize that the reason I want to heal trauma is because it will help all of humanity heal trauma, then fully be committed to that, because that intention is what's going to inform your work. If in my case, it's like I'm completely committed to the evolution of human consciousness, because that is for me personally where I personally have evolved to and where I feel like I can make the most difference. Well, because of that, that's what informs all of my work. My every choice, my every decision in terms of healing work is all around consciousness as a whole. And that includes the healing the traumas and the upsets that people have. But the underlying intention and foundation of my work is evolution of consciousness, right? If yours is healing childhood trauma, bringing mothers and children back together, helping families, helping veterans move on with their life, whatever it is, fully understand it and be committed to it. In other words, seek out with great enthusiasm, hidden motives, because those hidden motives are going to inform your work and they will be damaging to people that you work with.
Mm. Sage advice. Well, Tony, thanks for talking to me. I think I just need to,
as always,
I just need to keep having different podcasts so I can have you be guests on different podcasts. And you know, right? Like, I'll just think of like, what do I want to talk to Tony Moss about? And then I will start a podcast on that subject. And I will be committed to it.
Exactly. You know, and the last thing I want to share, just to wrap things up.
Yeah.
All of the work that we're doing with this work is so that we can lead better human lives, right? And the thing I'd say, you know, part two of like, what do I say to people, you know, that want to do this work is like, looking at why you're doing it. Ultimately, you want to make the world a better place, right? And you want human beings to enjoy the experience of being human and being on this planet more, right? That's plenty of motivation.
And I love having a good conversation. Right. And that's part of what I share, you know, that's part of my
Absolutely.
Medicine. And for the listener, you know, you have your medicine. And part of this podcast series is to help you unlock it through listening to people who may be a little further along the path that you want to take, which is why having someone like you, Tony, on the show is just amazing, because you are 100% a statesman in this work. You know, you are someone who, when you speak, I and many others listen. And that's why I'm so honored to have you on the show and as one of the first
Thank
guests.
You.
So. Thank you so much, Tony. It's been a great pleasure.
Anytime, and I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.